This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he spoke to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov by phone on Friday and urged Moscow to accept a U.S. offer to release women's basketball star Brittany Griner and another American detainee, Paul Whelan. It was Blinken's first talk with his Russian counterpart since before Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February. Blinken did not provide details of Lavrov's response to what he had called a substantial proposal for Russia to release Whelan or Griner.
I urged Foreign Minister Lavrov to move forward with that proposal. I'm not going to characterize his response, and I can't give you an assessment of whether I think things are any more or less likely, but it was important that he hear directly from me on that.
Blinken had publicly requested the call and revealed the existence of the offer to Russia, which people familiar with says involves a swap for Whelan and Griner with convicted Russian arms dealer Viktor Bout. Blinken described the call as a frank and direct conversation centered primarily on the proposal for the release of the Americans. He also said he pressed Lavrov on the importance of Russia following through on an agreement to allow Ukrainian grain shipments to leave the Black Sea, and warned him of consequences should Moscow move ahead with suspected plans to annex portions of eastern and southern Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia and Ukraine have accused each other of shelling a prison in a separatist region of eastern Ukraine. Separatist authorities in the Donetsk region said an attack on Friday killed at least 53 Ukrainian prisoners of war who were captured after the fall of Mariupol in May. Russia accused Ukraine of launching missiles, but Ukraine accuses the Russians of shelling to cover up alleged torture and execution of Ukrainians there. This is VOA News. Pope Francis has assailed the Catholic missionaries who, quote, supported oppressive and unjust policies against indigenous peoples, AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Francis has vowed to pursue truth and healing as he wraps up his pilgrimage to Canada by meeting with native delegations in far north Nunavut. Francis is hoping his apology tour of Canada will help the Catholic Church reconcile with indigenous peoples and has committed to continue on a path of healing to atone for the past. His apologies have received a mixed response, though, with some school survivors welcoming them and others saying far more needs to be done to correct past wrongs and pursue justice today. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A Florida man is accused of selling toxic bleach as a cure for coronavirus. He's now been extradited to the U.S. AP correspondent Jennifer King has more.
Mark Grennan, the Archbishop of the Genesis II Church of Health and Healing in Bradenton, Florida, had an appearance in Miami federal court Thursday, almost 2 years after he was arrested in Colombia. He's the latest to face charges for peddling ineffective or downright dangerous substances as medicines to cure COVID-19. Officials say the church manufactured, promoted, and sold chlorine dioxide as a miracle mineral solution that could cure a vast variety of ailments, ignored court orders to stop, and threatened a federal judge. The substance turns into a toxic industrial bleach when ingested. Grennan and his sons Jonathan, Jordan, and Joseph were indicted on one count each of conspiracy to commit fraud and two counts each of criminal contempt. The trial is set to begin September 12th in Miami. I'm Jennifer King.
Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is asking government officials and people working in the private sector to save energy by giving up neckties. He appeared at a news conference in an open-necked white and blue shirt. Sanchez explained he dressed less formally, not as a nod to casual Friday, but to curb utility use. He didn't say how going tieless conserves energy, though. Spain has sweltered for more than a month. Temperatures in the country have often surpassed 40 degrees Celsius or 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Recapping our top story, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he spoke to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov by phone on Friday and urged Moscow to accept a U.S. offer to release women's basketball star Brittany Griner and another American detainee, Paul Whelan. It was Blinken's first talk with his Russian counterpart since before Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February. Blinken did not provide details of Lavrov's response to what he had called a substantial proposal for Russia to release Whelan and Griner. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's a lot of money. That's why that product cannot be used today in low and middle income countries.
That was Hervé Verhoosel, spokesman for Unit Aid, which spearheaded an agreement to allow generic production of the long-acting injectable HIV prevention drug. Details coming up. Also, African energy giants Algeria, Nigeria, and Niger have signed a memorandum of understanding on a vast gas pipeline project offering Europe potential alternatives to Russian supplies. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Kenya's authorities have called on Facebook to do more to rid the platform of hate speech ahead of the August 9th general elections. Rights groups Global Witness says the social media company approved hate speech advertisements promoting ethnic violence. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
Research has shown how social media has played a destructive role in elections worldwide, enabling parties and individuals to stoke unrest by disseminating hateful speech and misinformation. Rights group Global Witness set out to study whether the biggest social media platform, Facebook, was able to detect hateful and insightful messages concerning Kenya's election, and whether Facebook was prepared to deal with the haters and those spreading fear. In June, Global Witness submitted 10 ads in English and 10 in Swahili, which contain hate speech. The senior advisor of the agency, John Lloyd, said the hateful messages were approved.
We submitted the adverts in batches of 3 to 4 ads, first submitting the Swahili ads, then the English ads. We did this as our hypothesis was that Facebook was more likely to have weaker controls in Swahili than in English. All of the Swahili ads were accepted without any issue, often just within a few hours. Our first set of English ads, 3 ads, were actually initially rejected for a violation of Facebook's grammar and profanity policy, and we were invited to amend the ads and resubmit them.
Lloyd says they made an adjustment to correct the grammar and profanity, and the ads were accepted. In Kenya, Facebook has about 10 million users. As this African nation prepares to elect a new president on August 9th, experts warn there is a risk of ethnic violence propagated on the platform and the spread of misinformation. In a statement, Facebook admitted Friday to have missed some hate speech messages as people and machines they rely on making mistakes. It also says they have Swahili speakers and technology to help remove harmful content and have invested in people and technology to help ensure safe and secure elections in Kenya. But Lloyd of Global Witness said it appears Facebook is not capable of dealing with the issues of hate speech that threatens Kenya's political stability. Kenya's National Cohesion and Integration Commission, tasked with addressing and minimizing ethnic tensions, says it has seen less in-person hate speech in this year's campaign compared to past years. But Danvas Makori, one of the members of the government-funded commission, says the problem has not gone away.
Hate speech has migrated from political rallies and platforms to social media platforms. No longer do we see politicians engaging in hate speech in rallies, okay? Today, they use their proxies, whether it's bloggers, to conduct and propagate hate speech, mostly online.
Kenya's previous elections have been characterized by ethnic tensions and violence, most notably the 2007 polls when post-election violence killed more than 1,100 people. Global Witness is calling on Facebook to take the Kenyan election seriously and protect users from speech that could cause a repeat of that violence. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
A local Somali official has welcomed a plan by Ethiopia's Somali state to create a buffer zone along the border inside Somalia to fight militant group Al-Shabaab. The plan was announced yesterday, a week after hundreds of Somali militants launched a cross-border attack that Ethiopian authorities say they repelled. Somalia's federal officials have yet to comment on an Ethiopian buffer zone inside their country, and some security analysts warn it could create more tension. Mission, Mohamed Hassan reports for Mogadishu, Somalia.
The president of Ethiopia's Somali state, Mustafa Omar, has announced that his administration will create a buffer zone inside Somalia to prevent Al-Shabaab militants from entering Ethiopia again. He was speaking to media at the front, flanked by his senior security commanders. He said Al-Shabaab fighters entered the region from several directions last week, but have been beaten badly and security forces are searching for their remnants. Omar said the first phase of the fighting has been concluded and outlined the next step Ethiopia plans to take. He says the second phase will be to create a security buffer zone inside Somalia that is free of terrorists, because he says we can't wait for the enemy here. Mohamed Malim Ahmed is the mayor of Hodur, the capital of Somalia's Bokol region, which borders Ethiopia. He said Friday that the regional administration welcomes the plan by Ethiopia's Somali state to create a buffer zone inside Somalia to fight Al-Shabaab terrorists. Speaking with VOA via phone, Ahmed said that they are ready to work with the Ethiopia's Liu security forces to defeat Al-Shabaab. We, the government of the southwest of Somalia, we are ready to work with the Liu police to unite and come together to fight them. We don't see a problem if the security forces of Somalia's region of Ethiopia reside in our areas, and the public fear regarding their coming will be discussed to avoid harming the civilians and only target the enemy. Liu police have been present in Somalia border towns for some time, and it was not clear what steps Ethiopian authorities would take to establish a formal buffer zone. Abdul Wahab Sheikh Abdi Samad is a Horn of Africa strategic studies analyst and African affairs commentator. He told VOA via WhatsApp that creating a buffer zone inside Somalia is a bad idea.
And in my view, the idea of the joint military exercise between the Somali National Army and Liu police, I think it's still about the Somali public. It's doable. But creating a buffer zone inside Somalia is not a noble idea. And I don't think so that will work. And that also will create unnecessary tension between the two countries and must be avoided. Why right now, what's the significance of the, you know, creating a buffer zone inside Somalia? What's the idea? Why, you know, who is pushing the idea itself? In the long run, it will create a problem between the two states.
Somalia's federal government have not commented on the proposed buffer zone, but the new Prime Minister, Hamza Abdi Barre, has ordered security agencies to respond to Al-Shabaab attacks in the border towns in the Bokol region. Security forces in Ethiopia said they killed more than 100 Al-Shabaab militants after they crossed into the eastern Ethiopia last week. U.S. assessments suggest the Al-Shabaab fighters might have penetrated as far as 150 kilometers into Ethiopia before being stopped. Meanwhile, Al-Shabaab said Friday that it attacked the town of Ato near the Somali border with Ethiopia. Residents told VOA that they have had multiple explosions and heavy fire exchange. Casualties are yet unknown. Al-Shabaab has been fighting the Somali government and African Union troops in Somalia for more than 15 years, carrying out attacks in Somalia and neighboring Kenya. Experts believe that the group's attack in Ethiopia is meant to show the group is still very dangerous to the security of the Horn of African countries. Mohamed Daisane, VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
A U.S. judge in the U.S. state of Virginia has recommended issuing a default judgment against Khalifa Haftar, head of the Libyan National Army, LNA. Khalifa Haftar, who has been a Virginia resident for decades, tried to have the lawsuits tossed out under the claim of immunity. As head of state, however, his attempts seem to have been unsuccessful. VOA's English to Africa service, Hasuna Bayush, is at the court where the judgment was announced. Hasuna, tell us more about what happened today regarding Khalifa Haftar.
Yes, a federal U.S. judge issued today a default judgment against Libyan commander Khalifa Haftar, finding him liable for war crimes against several Libyan families who have accused him of extrajudicial killings and torture. Now, keep in mind that today's ruling had to do with three separate civil suits against Haftar seeking monetary compensation. It's not a criminal suit. It's basically a civil suit. Just to give you a background, in April 2019, Haftar launched a military assault on the capital, Tripoli, which resulted in the killing of hundreds of Libyan citizens. Multiple Libyan family had filed lawsuits against Haftar in U.S. court in 2019 and in 2020, in which Libyan commander was accused of torturing and killing the relatives. Now, the families filed their lawsuits under what's called the Torture Victim Protection Act of 1991. This law allows non-U.S. citizens to seek sort of a compensation for individual who act in an official capacity for any foreign nation allegedly committed torture, and extrajudicial killing. But more importantly, Haftar, as you mentioned in the beginning, is a U.S. citizen who had been a Virginia resident for decades, which means that he has assets in the U.S., if any, that definitely can be used to pay compensation to the victims who won their case.
So the families who are seeking compensation, I guess under, it says, the Torture Victims Protection Act of 1991. So what are they asking? Are we looking for a monetary judgment here?
Correct. I personally did not get to speak to family members, but I spoke to some advocates and activists who were in the courtroom today. And they told me that the Libyan family members welcome today's ruling, as they call it a major victory following 3 years of civil litigation to hold Haftar accountable. So they're definitely seeking a monetary compensation here.
So this thing is very serious. You know, they're seeking compensation under the, you know, victim protection thing. And he is actually being accused of terrorizing people. I mean, should Haftar be found guilty of war crimes in a U.S. court, could it affect his ability as an international actor and seek, you know, cooperation from Washington as well as the allies could be impossible?
Very good question. Very, very, very plausible. Because with Haftar now being found liable in a civil lawsuit, some activists hope that this will now lead to a path towards criminal prosecution against him, which is, again, it's very possible. But the most serious potential ramification for him will be in Libya, meaning that since Haftar is a presidential candidate, meaning that if today's ruling leads towards criminal prosecution, then he might not be able to run for the presidency. He might be, you know, disqualified for the top position. But as for now, the next step in the legal case is a hearing where the judge will evaluate what kind of compensation package the family should receive.
Correspondent Hassuna Beishu from the English to Africa Service, thank you for your input. A Malawian rights activist has been found safe a day after his reported abduction led to the cancellation of an anti-government protest. Lamek Masina reports from Balantyre, Malawi.
An eyewitness said five men abducted Sylvester Namiwa, the head of the Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives, as he was leaving a press conference Wednesday. He was found alive Thursday afternoon in a bush in the Natenje area on the outskirts of Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. Edwin Mauluka is the spokesperson for the CDED.
I was this morning with him and we escorted him to police. The issue is in the hands of police because we reported the matter to police that Mr. Namiwa was found there at in Natenje.
Namiwa spoke to reporters after his reappearance Thursday. He said he would not give details on his alleged abduction until he talked with his lawyers and family members. However, he said he believed the abduction was a government ploy to silence dissenting views.
I'm betting the last drop of my blood to defend this democracy. Chakwera and his Malawi Congress Party are a threat to democracy, but I cannot be intimidated.
Police said Friday they have taken a statement from Namiwa and are conducting an investigation. Harena Mwanza is the deputy spokesperson for the Malawi Police Service.
After taking a statement from him, there are also other things you have to do, like visiting all scenes where he was allegedly taken to. So that's when we are done with the our investigations. And now we can give an update in terms of what you have found and what would be the way forward, because we have also to identify those behind this alleged abduction.
The abduction of Namiwa ignited a war of words in Parliament Thursday. Minister of Homeland Security accused the opposition Democratic Progressive Party of carrying out the abduction to tarnish the image of the government. The DPP lawmakers accused the government of abducting Namiwa to foil an anti-government protest that was planned Thursday. The protest was cancelled in Lilongwe, but the demonstrations went forward in other areas where police fired tear gas to disperse people who allegedly wanted to loot shops and vandalize property. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
People in Guinea were in the streets of the capital Conakry yesterday defying a ban on demonstrations to protest the military junta that came to power in September of 2021. The protest brought the West African country's capital to a standstill, and scattered clashes broke out between police and young demonstrators. The National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, a powerful coalition of political parties, trade unions, and civil society organizations, called for the protest to denounce what it termed the junta's contempt and arrogance and its unilateral management of attempts to return to civilian rule. Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, who overthrew President Alpha Condé last year, has pledged to hand over power to elected civilians within 3 years. But regional powers have rejected this timeline. A senior Ethiopian official says the government is ready for talks with rival forces from the northern Tigray region anytime, anywhere, and without preconditions, in a notable break from the past. William Davison is an Ethiopian senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. His latest article is titled, "At Long Last, Ethiopia Prepares for Peace Talks." I started out by asking him why the two sides are now ready to move towards negotiations.
Well, it seems that part of the reasoning is that the two parties were engaged with other allied forces, were engaged in such a brutal conflict over the last 18 months or so, with no clear resolution to it. So, a certain amount of exhaustion from the conflict and the consequences of that, obviously devastating. A failure to achieve their political objectives by military means, that seems to have contributed to the decision to try, at least make some sort of effort to pursue a negotiated outcome. And we could also, very much part of that is the economic conditions, the terrible conditions in Tigray, which remains almost totally isolated.
So what obstacles would negotiations face should they get going?
We do have a fairly major disagreement over who should lead the mediation. The federal government wants the African Union and the envoy, Olusegun Obasanjo, to lead the mediation. Tigray seems to favor Kenya and the current president, outgoing president Kenyatta, and say that Obasanjo is too close to Addis. So that's actually a fairly major obstacle. We also have very recently Tigray's president, Debretsion Gebremichael, saying that services need to be restored to Tigray before talks can commence, and also suggesting that the issue of Western Tigray needs to be resolved and returned to Tigray from Amhara control before talks can begin. That's another major potential obstacle here. There's also the significant issue of the size of the forces that Tigray has built up during this war. They will be looking to maintain that force for Tigray's security. But that force is seen as a threat by the federal government, also by Amhara and Afar regional government, and also by Eritrea's government as well. So the issue of Tigray's forces is there. We also have the continuing federal designation of the TPLF, Tigray's ruling party, as a terrorist organization. So at some point, presumably, there would have to be some movement on that if this peace process is going to be successful. So there are obstacles getting the talks underway, but even when the talks get underway, there are incredibly tricky, thorny political challenges that will need to be overcome.
You mentioned the large force, the Tigray force. Could armed confrontations flare back up again?
Yes, it's still in a very volatile situation, obviously. At the moment, further confrontation between the Ethiopian National Defense Forces and Tigray forces doesn't look so likely. You know, that's been one of the improvements over the past 7-8 months now. But of course, there is still the potential for confrontation. They're also very much between Tigray's forces and the Eritrean military. They're facing off across the border in the north. We've seen skirmishes.
And Mr. Davison, let's conclude by the role of foreign partners in the negotiations. What is the role?
The important role is this potential mediator role for any talks to get underway. You know, is that going to be the African Union? Is that going to be Kenya's government or some sort of partnership between them? So that will be an absolutely critical role. We then also have some other partners supporting the process. So the US and its envoy, now Ambassador Mike Hammer. We have the European Union and its regional envoy, also the UN Secretary General's envoy. They're all playing sort of supporting roles here, engaging in shuttle diplomacy, facilitating whatever, helping to support whatever mediation process gets underway. To some extent, the United Arab Emirates have been involved. So all of these partners are either involved in facilitating, potentially hosting, mediating the talk, or sort of encouraging the parties.
That was William Davison, Ethiopian analyst for the International Crisis Group. He talked to me from Nairobi, Kenya. Global health agencies say a voluntary licensing agreement has been reached to allow for the genetic production of the first and only long-acting injectable HIV prevention drug. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Until recently, cabotegravir, the HIV prevention medication, was available only in pill form and had to be taken daily or in some cases before and after sex. The injectable form can provide 2 months of continuous protection against HIV infection through a single intramuscular injection. Hervé Verhoosel is spokesman for UNITAID, the global health initiative that spearheaded the agreement. He says the price of the injectable drug is prohibitive, noting a year's supply in the United States costs $20,000.
It's a lot of money. That's why that product cannot be used today in low and middle-income countries. This license will in fact give the option to three different generic manufacturers to develop the product on a generic base. Of course, that will help to bring the price of the generic version down.
Data from UNAIDS, the United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, finds 1.5 million people were newly infected with HIV last year, including some 650,000 deaths. Verhoosel says cabotegravir will be available to people at high risk in the least developed, low-income, lower-middle-income, and sub-Saharan African countries. He says people with high rates of infection will benefit most from this medication. They include men who have sex with men, sex workers, transgender women, adolescent girls, and young women.
And I would like to insist on the importance of protecting adolescent girls and young women. In sub-Saharan Africa, the epicenter of the epidemic, the HIV infection rate of adolescent girls aged 15 to 19 is six times that of the male peer, and six times greater.
Verhoosel says the agreement will give selected manufacturers the opportunity to develop and supply generic versions of cabotegravir in 90 countries, where more than 70% of all new HIV infections have occurred. He notes it might take 2 or more years to develop the generic product. He says the price, which is not yet known, will likely be determined then. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.